I think it's more true than most people realize. It is the influence that AI has on your thoughts, your line of thinking. I have never found anyone yet that overstated it to me. Everyone that tries to overstate it is actually understating it.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast, the podcast that is dedicated to bringing diverse global voices together to help build fair and equitable AI regulation. I'm your host, Sanjay Puri, and today we have a truly fascinating guest joining us. We have Yap Van Etten, a diplomat turned entrepreneur with over a decade of experience in China, working at the Dutch Embassy in Beijing and the consulate in Shanghai. His unique background has led him to found Datena, now the leading provider of techno-economic intelligence on China. Yap, it's such a pleasure to welcome you to our podcast. Welcome to the show.
Sanjay, it's a pleasure to be here in your podcast. Looking forward to today's conversation.
Wonderful. Yeah, for our global audience, can you tell them about your journey from you were a diplomat and now you are a tech entrepreneur? What inspired this transition?
Actually, a struggle that I have and had in my own work to just not being able to grasp the growth of China with just manual labor. And seeing that China's innovation policy wasn't only having benefits for the West, but actually also had a potential negative outcomes.
So that kind of led you to say, hey, I really need to do something. So you said it had some negative outcomes for the West. Can you explain your company Datena's approach to open source intelligence and how AI plays a role in that work? And explain what is open source intelligence for our audience who might not know what that is.
I'll start with the latter. So what is open source intelligence? This relates back to your first question. So what I saw in news articles when I was working there was that state-owned enterprises in China were buying, acquiring Dutch high-tech companies and European high-tech companies. I saw a massive amount of innovation, state-funded research projects, not just at universities, but also state-funded research projects at companies. And I felt, how large scale is this? How many of these acquisitions are actually state-funded? How much of this R&D is state-funded? And when I was manually collecting information, going to websites, downloading PDFs, copy-pasting stuff into Excel, I could see the outlines of a picture of a China's industry policy. And that is in itself is open source intelligence already, where you're using public information, news articles, government publications, university publications to get intelligence on something else. So in this case, on the Chinese industry policy. What I struggled with was because of the size of China and the speed of innovation, to do this at a large enough scale that made sense for actually giving input to our policy. And in that case, at that point, our Dutch innovation policy. So given my background at the search engine before I became a diplomat, I felt that if I can combine that knowledge that I have with the knowledge that I have about China and in the OSINT, the open source intelligence that I see out there on the Chinese internet, if I can make this into a mass scale innovation collection system, that will really help seeing the bigger picture, but also on the granular side. So in that sense, that is what Datena is doing. It is basically what I could do on my own. So manually collecting OSINT on Chinese industry policy, but then at a scale of maybe doing it 50 times larger because there's basically no limits to what you can do with a software system.
You're basically using AI to really ingest so much data that you're gathering and then try to figure out, do data analysis to really gather data points, right? Yeah.
Correct. There's actually 3 points in the fourth, but I'll get to that. 3 points where we use AI. So it's on the data collection side, really knowing which part of the data is interesting that you need to collect. Then there's the analytical side. So once you have the data, what does data mean? How can you merge it together? Which data point can you connect to what other data point? And then there's the interface side, where we can also use, and we also use AI. So for instance, with our AI assistant, which is an LLM, where people can type in questions that they have when they are not used to our interface or have a question which our interface doesn't capture yet. So these are three pillars. And then the fourth pillar, I always tell people, we also track China's AI. So that's the fourth, but it's not part of our product, of course, more of a side effect of our product.
How do you think the cultural differences between the West and China impact development, especially in China, or just overall? The West has a certain approach, especially the US. Europe has a certain approach. What is China's approach to AI development?
Yeah, a great question. I thought about it in advance because it's a question I get more often. What I saw in my time in China, and I saw in my time in Europe, and more recently in the past years, my time in the US, I really saw three different mindsets, which you see when you meet both the common people and the politicians, because politicians are often like a accumulation of what the general public does or top down. But in China, it was very much more often about control. It was already when I first arrived there 2005 about how can we control 3G? How can we control television? It was still a big thing, just general linear television. So innovation, how can we control innovation into the right flow? Where here is in that there still is still the same for AI, where in Europe, it's about how can we regulate AI to protect our citizens? And in the US, it's how can we foster and stimulate AI innovation? All three have different pitfalls and advantages. So I wouldn't consider there's one better than the other, but it's very important to know that they are so distinct, because it also means that companies who are active in Europe will initially create their whole business model, their mindset, their company values, or even their ethical checklist to a European mindset. And then when they go to China or to the US, they have to be very wary of that and be aware of that. So that's the high level differences that I think exist.
You've had a long experience in China. How has that shaped your understanding of the global technological development sphere that happens?
What I experienced there was firsthand the real hunger for technology already. And now we're talking more about it with the recent export control regulation being a lot tighter than before. But already in early as 2013, I really noted that there was a hunger for technology, that China wanted to be technologically independent from the West for economic, nationalistic, and military reasons. And this hunger for technology comes from the fact that in the past they have been, sometimes they made their own mistakes in the past, where they didn't get on the bandwagon of new technology or the whole industrial revolution too late, but they've been excluded from certain technologies more often in the past. So for them, it's really the build or buy decision that we, for instance, in the Netherlands can make. If we can't build it, if it's economically not viable for us, or the best decision to build something, we'll just buy it. But for China, that didn't work. And on top of that, the country is large enough that they could consider, let's just build everything in-house. And at least we have the key to the technological kingdom. So that's a different mindset than what we have in the West. It was all about optimization. Capitalism is about optimization of resources. Yeah, that doesn't go well if you try to mix that with a focus of an industry where they say, first thing, we want to have everything in-house. Second thing, we optimize. But first, it's really about, so that's what I really experienced firsthand with the Chinese government decision-making. At the same time, I saw in the Chinese entrepreneurial mindset, a lot more the US spirit to really build fast, break things, try hard. That was really inspiring actually to see that in my time in China.
So the entrepreneurs are like US, take risks, build fast, but the government has some state controls. Yeah. One question I had for you, and this is something that's fascinated me, is China has been ahead and talked about being a leader in AI for a large period of time. From the top down, the government has talked about AI. Now in the US, it's since ChatGPT came out that we've now got an AI, national AI policy. We're really pushing hard. We want to be the leaders, etc. Why is AI so important for China or for the Chinese government? Is there any specific reason? You talked a little bit about build versus buy. Is there some cultural history of being left behind, as you talked about? But what is about AI that is driving them? And obviously, there are some other technologies, but AI, electric vehicles is something else. But for our listeners, that would be, what's about AI?
For me, when I lived in China, I've been to stem cell facilities, I've been to nuclear power plants, I've been to advanced material institutes, big data centers, and I've had CEOs and CTOs coming over from all these technologies. But also my own assessment was already more than 10 years ago, and I think I even wrote a LinkedIn post about it. When are you going to have your Kasparov moment? When are you going to experience that AI will outcompete with you? So in that sense, I think the Chinese government just came to the same conclusion that AI is one of these like technologies that enable a lot of other technologies. This is an enabling technology. So there's many emerging technologies, but there's only like a handful of enabling emerging technologies. I think the Chinese leadership is, and there's quite some meetings taking place in Beijing. They're called like Fragrant Hills meetings, where government is educated on new technology. So stem cells and AI were already covered in the early 2000s there. So the leadership is, many of them have an engineering background, Western educated in the past. So they have a real understanding of technology. They know that they've been behind for a very long time. So they're always looking at, okay, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. So looking back at history, we see that new technological breakthroughs are what makes the winners and the losers. If we want to be the winner, we have to identify the new breakthrough technology. So that is what they did. They've identified that AI is going to be the new technology where winners and losers are going to be made. So we have to be the winner. Then we have to be the best at AI. Don't get me wrong, though. In the West, several people, I think it was already at the Obama administration in the Office for Science and Technology, that wrote that AI was on the same level as nuclear technology. So it's not that we didn't know it. It's just that for some reason, action wasn't taken with it. And that in China was done much faster. And I think that comes from the Chinese entrepreneurial mindset in the with the entrepreneurs, in combination with leadership that was very much in favor of, okay, if you pitch something good on technology, we'll give you the money. I think that worked really well with them.
Yeah, so there has been some element of visionary leadership also. We have to give that credit to the Chinese government that they have been thinking far ahead. It's a different approach. Yeah, there have been all kinds of indications that they have the largest number of AI experts in the world. What does your intelligence tell you? Is that assessment right? That's considered like a fact. You talk to AI experts here in the US or Europe, they'll say China has the largest number of AI experts.
The academic system of China in general is vast. So the amount of engineers being output by their academic system, that is indeed, like, if you have the amount of population in China, you start educating them again, opening up universities, that was just a matter of time before that would happen. I do still see that it varies a lot per topic still. I would say that certain topics, like in our fields, we do a lot with natural language processing, Chinese across the board everywhere. It's really a lot of Chinese papers are really great. I still feel that in more in chip design, AI chip design, or adversarial technologies on imaging technologies, still the quality of papers can still be lower. But I have to agree with the experts also from the academic side in this field that yes, Chinese output is substantial. Still, you can say that on the LLM side, even though that I said that on natural language processing, China is really great, the West still beat China to that point.
So, yeah, you talked about chip design. As the US has put restrictions on some high-end chips, especially NVIDIA GPUs, to go to China, we've even started putting controls in the Middle East because there were rumors that they were finding their way into China. I've had some guests here saying that this might slow them down, but this will not stop them because the state is now determined to make sure that they're independent and they're ahead in AI. What are your thoughts in terms of these sanctions? How is it impacting them? How is it putting them behind by a year, 2 years? And what is the Chinese government doing about this?
It's hard to put an exact number on it. Perhaps customers that use our data can actually do that when they can combine it with other information. But when it comes to what the effect will be, of course, they're going to invest more in whatever technology is being blocked. But they were already doing that anyway. As I already mentioned to you, they want to have full autonomy in key technologies, including AI. So yeah, it might make it even more pressing to do this. But I don't know, I think already was it 10 plus years ago, there was already a university where a professor was forced to create a digital signal processing chip that eventually got so much pressure that he used a fake chip to put on the market. And one of his PhD students actually was a whistleblower in China at that time, saying we're just buying chips in Japan and rebranding them as a breakthrough. I can really understand how the professor comes to that. That's just, there's so much pressure to do to move forward, but certain things take time. It's a lot easier to make progress in software, so in just pure software, AI. But when it comes to chip design, where you have to have what the Germans call like a Fingerspitzengefühl, like you have to know what you're doing. Often it's, you have to have it in your fingers. So it's an whole ecosystem. Just imagine that. I don't think that the US or Japan willingly gave the company a monopoly. It's not that they didn't try to build their own lithography machines. They're also really probably unhappy with the fact that we have one supplier. So they also really tried and to have access to the entire rest of the ecosystem so that they can buy equipment from Japan, from Europe, and they still can't manage to. But at the same time, I do think that don't underestimate the out-of-the-box thinking of the Chinese. So certain key elements, they can come up with something different. If I were the Chinese, I would try to follow the West in one pathway, but also have enough time, money available to try something completely different. That would also be my guess. I think also, honestly, that's also what we're seeing, what people should expect. I think the amount of unknown unknowns is going to increase from China on this field.
So the known unknowns will increase. And you talked about ASML, which is a key player. And there are now, I think, they had put some restrictions also on selling some of their equipment into China. Yeah. In your experience, what are some common misconceptions about China's technical capabilities and intentions that people have?
One that is hopefully less common, but in the early days, I ran to it often, and I'm still going to address it now. It was that when I first started tracking Chinese innovation, and people were mockingly telling me, like, oh, then you must have an easy job because China can't innovate. That still happened 10 years ago. Like this quote is from 10 years ago when I was just about to start Daytona. And yeah, to this date, that is in certain areas, still people underestimate the innovation power that China has. When I went to these Chinese companies, I could see that what they were doing there was also just fiddling, like trying stuff. And yes, it was done. And I'm talking now about the semiconductor industry. And yes, they were trying things that you felt like, okay, probably not going to work. But the fact that you're trying this means that you're not copying, because there's quite some literature out there that this doesn't work. They're really trying to do stuff. So that means that eventually they will figure things out. So that did came to the conclusion, hey, this is the kind of mindset that people need. I think that the pressure people are under to reach targets, talking about the professor that basically like, yeah, of course he didn't want to fake a chip. He didn't want to do that. But just that pressure amounts to so much that you start faking these things. Oh, you also had that kind of things in the West as well. Other publications, so I'm not trying to talk down one nation doing, but in pressuring this in the semiconductor industry is really what I saw there. Yeah, the size of the country, still the size of the ecosystem, the differences. Also, if you go to one place, one province, one city, can be completely different than from another city. So if you go to Shenzhen, you will see certain type of innovation. And because the markets are so large there, it might be that for these kind of companies, it's worthwhile to innovate on this small component and not do something else. So you might think, oh, they're stupid because they're not innovating this part. But for them to make money and just become a multimillionaire, fine. So I think in the beginning, people said China only copies. If you can become a millionaire with just copying, why would you make a risk to innovate it more, spending more money, right? Very hard to convince an investor to say like, hey, if you pay me this, I have 10x return. And if you pay me a lot more, I might have 20x, but not sure. So I think that's also a legacy that copied in China. Yeah, that's it's happening. It's still happening. It happened in the past. But get new data, I would say, depending on what industry you are, like every month, every quarter, like do a deep dive again to reassess the state of technology in China. Don't think about, oh yeah, I went there last year and that's it.
So what you're saying is things are moving very fast. And they're not just copying and cloning things, they're innovating things, and they're ready to make mistakes and learn from them is what you're saying. And that's what our listeners should keep in mind.
What I also often hear is that China, they do this for control and surveillance. And this is often mentioned because it just makes for a nice article in the newspapers. But it's less sexy, but more involvement. Like, they also do this for economic growth and global competitiveness. Out-innovate the global competition. I think that's also something that people often overlook.
Yeah, and I think if you overlook that, I think you need to just look at TikTok and the AI algorithm that exists in TikTok and look at the success they've had. And now there are several other examples that are coming in. Just shifting gears a little bit, what do you think Datena is basically in the business of helping some of the policy decisions, et cetera? What do you think of the use of AI in policy making and policy decisions?
You have to look at it from two sides. One side, I think, like, it's great, amazing, part of what we do. And I even think that we haven't even scratched the surface of our potential, us as a company and actually our clients, when it comes to how much better economic policy, foreign policy can become if you have AI to support you, to see all the connections. At the same time, you always have to ask as policymaker, what's the data lineage? Why am I making a decision? So that should be key. In our software, if customers want to know each of the data points that they see, we have full data lineage. We even know the ethical framework, how the data got collected. I think that is something that is key for decision-making, because you'll start to trust these AI systems more and more. Trust is good, but being able to check is better. And I think that is key. And it will be more and more almost like a must-have. If you have, just imagine our GDP growth from our average country, 1% can mean the difference between recession or growth. So it's about small details. If AI can help you to have like 0.5% or 1% better economic policy, okay, this is amazing for your country. So we haven't seen the beginning of this yet.
Looking to make the most out of AI advancements and innovation? Visit regulatingai.org to learn more about how best to optimize the use and integration of AI, and sign up for the Regulating AI newsletter to keep up to date with the latest in AI governance and regulation.
So what you're saying is it can really lead to some tremendous productivity, tremendous growth per se. How do you think, and we've had guests come here and talk about this, but should we have AI legislation address concerns that are related to the AI-enabled autonomous weapons? And should there be international agreements or regulations for that? As you can see, when you look at current wars, there are several going on. It's heavily based on autonomous weapons, whether it's drones or other warfare. There is no consistency or some specific regulations around that. What are your thoughts on that? Yeah,
I think it first starts with diplomacy on this topic. I have an open channel, open discussion. Different countries will have different starting points on what kind of legislation is required. I do see the potential pitfalls, the same thing that I just described for the economic advantages of using AI. AI policy will be the same, of course, for AI in military applications. And then it's one thing to have better military planning. I think that it feels more benign to use it to that extent. You can tailor to minimize casualties or to just outcompete strategy. But autonomous weapons, it will be hard to make legislations stick at this moment. We have to be honest, the global trust in the world between large countries is not what it should be. So countries trust each other less now than they did 10 years ago. That's going to be tough to have a global legislation or regulation in place, but at least I would say some kind of red phone line on it, akin to the nuclear threats. Start working on something now. What if an AI experiment went out of control? Is there a phone number that people can call each other like, okay, I made a mistake, can we help each other? Maybe we should have some kind of AI legislating boards in general, not just for the laws, but also for AI in general. Like, we have WHO, if a new infectious disease comes out, there's such a body, I think, to at least collect information. That, I think, is the bare minimum. Let's at least start with that.
Yeah, if I understand correctly, you're proposing that there should be something like a AI hotline that somebody, if something happens, then you can pick up the phone just like with a nuclear. And then you're saying a regulatory body like you have the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Group, something of that nature that would be a coordinating and other body. Now, AI nationalism has become a big thing. As you said, China did it, but now almost every country, or at least a lot of countries, whether it's in the Gulf, the Middle East, Asia, etc., are trying to say, hey, I don't want to be left behind. I didn't make it in the nuclear club, but I don't want to be left behind in the, so to speak, AI club. Now, if you look at that, how can you balance the national interest with the need for international cooperation for AI regulation? Because you have the EU doing their thing, you have US, we have elections coming up, and then China is doing their thing and other countries are doing that. What is your perspective? How do you balance national interest with the need for international cooperation?
Short answer is I don't have an answer. I think it's again, when it comes to economic security, national security, like a government has to provide two things to its citizens. This is food to eat, economic security, and shelter, which is national security. I falls in the middle of that. So it's like you need this for economic security, you need this for national security. So it's going to be hard to defend government policy of a country. And they say, okay, we don't care about AI. We'll buy it from someone else. Unless we get like really strict agreements within Europe, I can see this. So in European Union, where we say like, okay, let's facilitate this. Yeah, maybe other umbrella agreements where we do this, but I find it hard to think that if countries really understand what AI will do in the coming years and beyond, I even would see as I would doubt I can take a government sincere or seriously if they don't have a national policy on AI. Hence my first answer. I don't really have an answer to how we get out of this, because it is the duplication of measurements and of investments, which is not ideal, to say the least. It would be good for the shareholders of NVIDIA and the likes. For ASML probably as well, to have semiconductor factories all over the world. But for the world, it would be better, I think, if that investment goes into renewable energy, for instance.
As you said, things are changing. So one of the things Jensen Huang, who's the CEO of NVIDIA, has suggested to the leaders of different countries that every country should have their own AI to preserve their culture, language, and be independent. What do you think of that thought?
I think it's more true than most people realize. It is the influence that AI has on your thoughts, your line of thinking. I have never found anyone yet that overstated it to me. Everyone that tries to overstate it is actually understating it. Let's say this, my watch has AI in the near future. And I'm just talking to it and giving it like, hey, I read this new book on self-improvement. Let me help stick to the rules. I just want to do this. That book is written by someone. I will start to change my thoughts on this. And this is an active thought. But what if this is not an active thought, but this AI is built by someone else? That can be very benign. Even the fact that it's a US AI means that it will be first in English. So people who are better at English will first do it in English. Then it's about English books, which are more online, or English text, which is more on the internet. So if I look at the Dutch language, as a kid, as a 10-year-old, I was very much a beta person. I like mathematics, and I was always complaining, why are we learning other languages as well? This is time better spent on math. Actually, I just want to learn English, and I can skip Dutch. Then just have to learn one language, and then I can focus the rest of my brain on learning math, physics. But later, I also got to understand that the culture in itself is also a kind of like a generator of new ideas. You don't want to have a monoculture, because that can lead humanity down the wrong path. If we become like an N is one experiment, and that's already what some people say, of course, the whole globe is an N in one experiment, but it's even accelerated if we don't foster the different cultures. And I see this a lot in the Netherlands, where the city where we are in Eindhoven, in our own company, I think half of the people are not Dutch, and I see the city becoming more and more English. It's fine, actually, I enjoy it, because I've lived abroad so long that actually sometimes it's really enjoyable to just speak English and to be able to mingle with other cultures. That does mean that after a while, it becomes a blend. The blend can be good, it has advantages as well, but to have an AI, I think that that preserves a certain culture where there's value in that, which can create out-of-the-box ideas, is important. And I think that's what he is referring to, that otherwise you'll just get a one monoculture with a cookie cutter with all the ideas from basically the US as the leading AI LLM developer at this moment.
No, as you said, different countries need to do their thing. One thing that's a lot of the lawmakers that come on our show talk about is that AI is moving so fast. Every day there's something. It's first the LLMs came out, then you have multimodal, then you have agents, then you have text to video, Sora. I'm just covering some of them. How do lawmakers stay ahead of the curve, produce regulation, legislation that's going to impact a very changed world, and forget 5 years, but even in a year's time, and that our laws don't become obsolete?
Different ways to approach that. First, just hard work. Running a company, running a scale-up is like immensely a lot of work, what I do. But even I spend time on Coursera, learning LangChain in the evening, weekend hours on Saturday or Sunday, because I want to be able to be the best CEO for my tech part of the company and for my clients, that I know what's going on. So it's identifying these trends and just spending your own hours on it. Secondly, recruiting staff with this knowledge. So identifying again, what are the key things, or having I used to be a science and technology attaché, just have a science and technology officer on your staff. Thirdly, this becomes a bit more how we devise governments. It depends a bit per country, per government body, how this could work. To a certain extent, this goes a little bit in the Netherlands. If you are a party in parliament with just one seat, that's fine. You get the one seat. And the good thing about it is you get diversity. If a party cares a lot about animal rights, and at the beginning, they just get a small amount of people voting for them, they still have one seat in parliament, and maybe they can grow to two or three later on. Something which is not important enough to make it to the global agenda of all parties can make it to an agenda of one party. That's the good thing about it. The bad thing about it is that if you have maybe 100 seats in parliament, if you are a party with 12 seats or 15 seats, probably one of those 12 people has a technology background, or two of them, or three of them. And you can share and define, or you can have one science and technology officer that you share among them. But the moment you have more parties, all like single or double or three, like seat parties, they all have to know about everything from tax to technology to agriculture to energy. It's really a lot to take care of. And I think there, that will probably also have downsides, having a lower limit to how many seat people should get, so at least they are capable of being knowledgeable in a certain sector. Or additionally, if that doesn't work, or if you really want to keep the chance for parties to have just one seat in parliament, a more generic office for science and technology that gives lectures and lessons to the policymakers, where they have, so it becomes just like a curriculum. I think they just have to have a curriculum where they spend time, and we force them to spend time. Now they spend a lot of time on debates, but I think that we just force them. This time you can't have debate. This is just for learning about the new technologies. And every week you have to spend time. If you're not there, you get cut on your budget. It's something like that. You force them to make time available for this.
I think that's a good point, is force them or incentivize them to make time, is what you're saying. Yeah, tell our listeners what lessons can be learned from China's rapid technological development that might inform global AI regulation.
It links to, I think, what you just asked me. When I arrived here in 2000, I did a research on 3G, 3G mobile phone. They didn't have 3G yet. I was still playing Snake on my phone if I was in the subway with nothing else to do. And they waited several years to introduce 3G. And now they're volunteering 5G. In 10 years' time, I had to ring the alarm bells, 2014. Like, hey, this Chinese industry innovation policies really have a negative effect on ours. And another 10 years later, they're now the global player in many key technologies. So what do you think, where they will be in 10 years from now? I think a lot of policymakers in the West still think in linear steps. They've heard about Moore's Law, but they think, okay, Moore's Law is only in semiconductors. But it's in any breakthrough technology. It's in AI. I think in genetic engineering, they're even outpacing Moore's Law. I think that is what we can learn from China's fast pace. The world is malleable, changeable. If you're behind now, if you feel that you're behind, you can still catch up. It will go like this. And you can be on top of everything on one day, behind the next, and end up as number one again weeks after.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, in terms of advancements in AI technology impacting national security concerns, what should be some considerations that legislators should keep in mind when they're framing AI-related legislation?
Three things come to mind. I think if we talk about national security, this influence operations, military capabilities, and cybersecurity, I think, will be the third one that I want to mention. I'll start with the last one, cybersecurity. I think AI hackers, and then also AI defense. If you don't do that, it's pointless. When I was still in China, the Chinese Great Firewall was cumbersome at points, because you want to look at websites in the West, and sometimes they're not available. So you start reading about technologies to circumvent them. And I think it was an Italian researcher at some point, and this is already, again, 10 years ago, but this is like a public thing to talk about, so I can talk about it. They used genetic AI algorithms to find holes in the Chinese Great Firewall, and they could. They published a paper about it, and later on, the Chinese plugged that hole. But it was interesting to see that already at that time, like an AI application, and since then I've seen AI applications that could find unintentional backdoors in open source code. So this is going to be a massive challenge. It might turn out that the world gets more secure, to become like AI against AI, and that at some point before we release new hardware, new software, we have a massive neural network to find out if this is rigid code. But at least short term, really, cybersecurity is going to be a new game. Then the influence campaigns that you were talking about, TikTok. I was talking about how every AI will be able to influence people without knowing it. People think that a social network was able to nudge people into a different direction. I'll think again, if you have an AI whispering in your ear without even whispering it. Basically, you could ask an AI, hey, this is the person, this is what I know about the person. In 100 steps, how can you get this person from this opinion to that opinion? And it will guide the person, not overdoing it, but giving one message, one word difference, one this, and also backing off a bit when the person is like responding differently. It might even use impersonation with that, so fake deep fakes. So I see there a massive challenge where post-truth like era has started, and I don't think we even realize it yet. And then the third one, which was the second one that I mentioned, the military capabilities. I'm a big fan of sci-fi, and it's often an inspiration to get new ideas. One thing that always struck me as weird was with any kind of sci-fi series you saw in space, people were flying, and then when things really got tough, they were like, let's switch to manual now. And then the person got out of things, and thanks to good flying. No, this is never going to happen. Like, AI will do things that you have 1 million inputs and you'll fly in ways. And why is even a person there? Because who cares? 6G, as long as the titanium can hold it, let's do this. So I think that AI in military capabilities, the sky is not even the limit, because space is also there. So I think that's going to be a real threat.
No, that's a pretty comprehensive evaluation that you've done. Even in the EU AI Act, and even with the conversations that Senator Schumer had, the EU AI Act doesn't address the military and the intelligence side, and nor does the US side. How do legislators balance the need for secrecy in national security operations with the public's right to understand and scrutinize the use of technologies, and especially as it relates to regulation?
Yeah, that's a tough one. My first thought always still is, we wouldn't publish the blueprints of a nuclear bomb online either, nor will we publish a DIY kit on how to make a new virus online. So my first glance would be, we don't know yet what the new nuclear bomb is. So I feel that the government is in their right to hold back a bit on publishing what groundbreaking research is, and then first assessing themselves. What does it mean? I'm hoping that at least like-minded countries have some kind of board where they can discuss things, or at least at a national level. Like in the Netherlands, we also have an oversight committee on our intelligence agencies. I think that should also happen. So if a new AI developments taking place that has potential military applications, or where the government is saying we want to keep this a secret for a while, that there is a independent auditory commission that looks at this decision. But first, I think their government, I think they have a responsibility there to do think carefully about what it means to open source that. Also taking into account that other parties might not do that. So then you're spending a lot of money into a recent development. And then, hey, we found something. Is that immediately taken by someone else at zero or no cost? And they will do things with that, which yeah, you might have not want them to do.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Yep. Yep. We have a big audience out there, legislators, think tanks, and others. What would your advice be as they are all working to put together regulation and legislation around AI around the world? What would your, with all the years of experience you have, is what advice would you have for them?
I would start with scenario planning, foresight exercises that really different people from different backgrounds make assessments on slow advancement, fast advancement, assessment on like what kind of industries, what kind of sectors, what kind of parts of society are going to be involved, and make assessments on what the effects would be, both positive and negative. I made this into a national dashboard, one public one and one not public one, where the non-public one eventually with delay becomes public, where governments are regularly updated on the advancement. So maybe related to your question, how can policymakers keep up to date? I think this is part of that. Because things can, it's like this leverage. If a new technology being developed in our own business plan from 2013-14, we had AI assistance for our tool. So that the export control unit could just ask what technology can I export to China? Or if I export this technology to China, what are the risks? Or within this sector, who are my competitors and why? I had no idea how to do this. I did know that at some point this technology would come. Still, if you asked me like a year and a half ago, I would have still said, still quite a bit away before this is ready for. And then, yeah, OpenAI launches ChatGPT, and that overnight, you have to change your business plan. So the government also needs to be in a position to do that. So that's like long-term planning, making these foresight assessments. But now things are going so fast, it has to become a dashboard for them. That this is really strategic thinking mixed with the technical operational thinking.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, in conclusion, there are two schools of thoughts, at least around the world, that we should engage with China as far as AI safety regulations are concerned, or we should not invite them. Now, I do know that when President Biden met President Xi in California, AI safety was discussed, and it's going to be discussed again too. And we have a NATO summit coming up. But should they be brought to the discussion in terms of what we want to do is in terms of global framing of AI legislation? What are your thoughts on that?
Without knowing, of course, all the details, what's going on in this kind of dialogue, that's this disclaimer there. Again, my first thought will be, yes, do invite them. It can be to smaller parts. That can also be the case. If you really feel like, hey, we have to discuss something which gives away too much about our technological capabilities, that I can understand. But I think China would also understand, and they will complain, of course, about it, that they won't be invited to everything. Then you can just ignore that complaint and just continue with a smaller group. But to not invite them, I think, would be a mistake. Because if they make a mistake with AI safety, it will affect all of us. So I think there's always our communication and our mutual understanding and our systems work is not great now. We're not in the same situation that we were 10, 15, 20 years ago. But I think we all hope to be in the same situation again, where we actually feel like, hey, we have one world. So if we screw up, like in terms of energy pollution or AI or nuclear threats, yes, there's a few people in the world out there where I sometimes doubt if they have the right understanding of this concept. But at least I'm hoping that most people in power have an understanding of this, that we have one world. So keep an open dialogue, agree to disagree on a few things, but yeah, this is the open dialogue will be my first assessment.
So keep an open dialogue. That's what Yap is suggesting. He's an expert. Yeah, towards the end, and like I said, I have so many other questions. We'll need to get you back here. But towards the end of the podcast, we try to ask a few questions in a lightning round. It's a pick one of the options, one of the two options we give you. Are you ready to take on a few questions for us?
Sure.
Okay. What would you prefer, national AI policies or international AI frameworks?
International AI framework.
Okay. Security or accessibility? What would you prefer?
Security.
AI regulation by technologists or AI regulation by policymakers?
I'm hoping the policymakers will be technologists, but I'm going for technologists.
That's a good one. In your view, is AI a greater risk or an opportunity for society?
Opportunity.
Finally, should autonomous weapons be banned or should they be allowed with restrictions?
I don't think we have a choice there, so it's going to be allowed with restrictions.
Wonderful. That has been a great session, really. Jaap, thank you so much for sharing your really invaluable insights. You have such amazing perspective. You bridge diplomacy, bring entrepreneurship, technological understanding, and a cue of you providing a critical viewpoint in this complex landscape of AI regulation. Given what's happening globally, the US, the Europe, the China relationship that's evolving, as we've discussed to our listeners, the challenges of creating fair and equitable AI regulations are immense, but so are the potential of getting it right. And your work at Datainnub provides critical intelligence to governments worldwide, undoubtedly playing a significant role in shaping informed policy decisions. Thank you for being part of our global conversation, Jaap. And to our listeners, I hope this discussion has provided you with new perspectives and food for thought. So until next time, this is Sanjay Puri signing off. Jaap, again, thank you. This was fabulous. Really enjoyed it and would love to have you back for part two, because there's, believe me, I have a feeling like 2 months, 3 months from now, there's going to be so much more to keep you busy and for us to have. So thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you, Sanjay. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the Regulating AI Innovate Responsibly podcast. You'll find links in the show notes to any resources mentioned on the show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you'll never miss an episode, and leave us a 5-star review.